And you'd be surprised how effective this can be when you take action immediately and solve the problem with the customer and become a true partner. So I love to do that. I love to go and see customers on a regular basis, just seek their input and do everything I can to continue to deliver values.
Welcome to How I Made It in Marketing from Marketing Sherpa. We scour pitches from hundreds of creative leaders and uncover specific examples, not just trending ideas or buzzword-laden schmaltz, real-world examples to help you transform yourself as a marketer. Now, here's your host, the Senior Director of Content and Marketing at Marketing Sherpa, Daniel Burstein, to tell you about today's guest.
One of my favorite career analogies is the music video for No Rain by Blind Melon. There's this girl in a honeybee costume. She's dancing around and she's so sad because no one seems to care or understand about her little dance. And then one bright day, she comes across this field and it's just filled with people in honeybee costumes hopping, leaping around. A look of elation crosses her face and she joins them to dance her best dance. Are marketing careers really that different? I thought of that analogy because, as my next guest puts it, find the place where you thrive. That's what we all want to do. So here to share the story behind that lesson, along with many more lesson-filled stories, is Tiffin Dano-Kwan, CMO of Amplitude. Thanks for joining us, Tiffin.
Thanks for having me, Daniel.
I feel bad. I said I wanted to make my French teacher proud in pronouncing your name. I think that's probably the worst I possibly could have done. So I apologize to Mrs. Dorenson right now. Let's take a quick look at Tiffin's background, though. Part of many roles she had, she was a marketing programs manager at Cognos Australian and New Zealand. She was a CMO of SAP Ariba and SAP Fieldglass at SAP, CMO of Dropbox, CMO of Calibra, and for the past 2 years, CMO of Amplitude. Amplitude is a public company traded on NASDAQ. Its annual recurring revenue in 2023 was $281 million, up 10% year over year. And Tiffin manages a team of 60 and a budget of $30 million. So Tiffin, give us a sense. What is your day like as CMO?
So first of all, Daniel, thank you very much for spending our time together. I really look forward to our conversation. And you know, this morning, like almost every morning, I usually wake up probably around 6 a.m. This is here in the West Coast, in the Bay Area. So I usually start very early and always have a morning ritual, which is my coffee with my spouse and our dogs. And that's really important for me. This is what gets me really in the zone. And, you know, you start really with family. That's an important part for me. And usually the first thing I check is my Slack, because my assistant gives me a full summary of my agenda for the day, which is a very quick snapshot that I always enjoy looking. So I'm a very routine-oriented person, and I like to have those things when I start my day. It really anchors me, gives me, I would say, the checkpoints that I need in order to get myself organized. And then from that point on, everything changes. What I mean by that is, like, I have my official agenda, which of course I'm receiving every day, but then you have the unofficial agenda that starts, and it always is like that. And that's part of the job. When you wake up and you lead a team and you're part of an executive team, you have to be ready every day to wake up and something's going to happen. Whether it's people-oriented, systems, comms-oriented, or other likes, you're going to have to deal with something that you didn't plan. So that to me is what describes usually my days. But it always thrive in a way to really have a routine and get organized. What I like to do every day is just making sure that I have a checklist next to me. I call it to-do, and it starts with a blank page of a paper. I like to write, and I'm a very visual person. So I like to tick the box of all the things that I need to do. And every day I start over and over. So I have lots of paper around me, but it keeps me really organized. It keeps me visually centered and focused on the things that need to happen, especially when I receive calls and meetings I would not plan, which is which is a daily the situation I'm in. So I love to do this. I usually have back-to-back calls. I am very people-oriented, collaboration-oriented. So I have many, many one-on-ones, whether with my directs, my stakeholders, my peers. And that usually really covers, I would say, a good 50% of my day. It's all related to connecting with people. Then I have also some allocated time to just do the work, whether it's creating executive presentations, reviewing presentations that are sent to me as a pre-read. I have to have the time to do it. I always have two of my favorite tabs open. One is my Tableau dashboard and one is my Salesforce dashboard. And, you know, I click on these all the time to look at numbers. These are things that I do on a refresh probably 5-10 times a day to really really get into the numbers and get into the business. So these are typical of what happens during the day. And then sometimes I do podcasts like the one with you today. Sometimes I do interviews of candidates. And most of the time, though, I spend the days just connecting with people.
No, I like that. It sounds like when you're saying that, I picture in my mind a pie chart. Like you've done a good job setting that pie chart. It's like, okay, this is the amount for people, the amount for getting work done, the amount for like seeing the numbers. And then there's that amount. Because I love how you say that. It's always going to be something. It doesn't always matter what it is, right? So no, for me, I know like here are my planned activities and I got to stay ahead of them. I got to stay ahead of those deadlines because I know something's coming up. So yes. I love how you say that. Yeah. Well, let's take a look at some of the lessons from some of the things you made from your career. That's a great thing we get to do as marketers. I feel like I've never been anything else like a podiatrist or an actuary, but like we get to make things. So let's take a look at some of these lessons. First, you say lead with empathy. So how'd you learn this lesson? How'd you learn to lead with empathy?
So that's it's a big statement. Everybody wants to have some level of empathy on the way they relate to work, on the way they relate to people. But the short answer is that I have learned that no one should ever view their career as a solo venture. You get from one point to another, not just on your own merit. There's a lot of people around you that makes it happen every day. I am so grateful for the many people who have taught me, pushed me, challenged me, and the empathy comes from interacting with people, great people, right? I'll give you an example. When I was in Singapore, I met an incredible leader. He was my boss there for a couple of years. His name is Lloyd Adams. He is now the president of North America for SAP. He's had a decades-long career over there. And he was sent in Singapore on a role where he was responsible for channel marketing and SMB marketing for the region. He was on an assignment. It was a short-term assignment. That's what big companies do. They send their top talents internationally. And I built an amazing rapport with him. He went back to the U.S. and he thought about me. And he talked to the team, the North American marketing team over there about me. And they were looking for a channel marketer at the time to build a program. And he positioned me before I even asked for it. That's true empathy. It's somebody who cared about me, knew I wanted to make it to the U.S. and positioned me. So he called me and said, Tiffany, there's a role for you. I've been talking about you, and they're really interested in you coming in and building whatever you built for me in Asia and do it in the U.S. So I learned empathy from the best. I learned empathy from incredible people who showed me how to give back, who showed me how to care deeply for people. And to this day, I'm grateful for him because he's been, first of all, an incredible leader, showed me the way. And whenever I have a chance now, I pay it forward. I try to help people I had a chance to do the same thing for someone when I was at SAP, who moved from Canada to New York. And empathy is about caring. It's about caring deeply for someone and doing everything you can for that relationship to be harmonious and to give someone a chance to thrive.
So I love that example, like that career example with a colleague, for lack of a better word. But I wonder, can you think of a specific example of using that empathy for customers, like better understanding those customers? I mean, that's where it's really hard to connect. For example, I wrote an article on empathic marketing in action. And one of the case studies was with Bank of America. It was during COVID. And their chief client care exec, she's talking about how, you know, they're trying to be empathetic with their customers, what's going to go on during COVID. And so they redeployed 3,000 employees from their brick and mortar banks to handle calls because people weren't going into banks anymore. So those became this giant work from home call center. They repositioned everyone because they realized their customers, they aren't going to want in-person interactions as much, but they're going to have some pretty serious financial challenges. And by doing this, even during COVID, they were able to hit an all-time high of 85.6% of customers being satisfied, even though obviously it was such a challenging time. So for you, Tiffin, can you think of a specific example from your career of how you've been empathetic with your customers, how you led with empathy, focusing on those customers?
You know, it's a great point. Once it happened early in my career, I was deployed to actually capture success stories from customers. So you go. I was in France at the time. You travel all over the country to go and meet customers who are supposed to share incredible stories with you. And instead, to my surprise, I would be in front of customers who had complaints about about the company. And it happens more often than you think. You start a conversation and then you start listening deeply to what they share with you, and then you realize it's not as rosy as you thought. And perhaps because you're so open in the conversation, they start sharing with you. And for what it's worth, you're there in front of them. So oftentimes, and that happened, especially over the last couple of years, you don't have as many resources in front of customers as before. So when they see you, they start telling you all the things that are not going well. So to my surprise, I was a marketer and I was in front of those customers telling me all the things they didn't have. They had issues with pricing. They had issues with customer service or support. So I acted almost as the liaison for these customers to come back to headquarters and say, hey, listen, I was there to capture a story. And instead, I heard all those things that customers need. So I was able to go back and talk directly to the management to ask for some direct support to those customers. That to me was a direct example of how I could help at my level just surface some of the challenges that some customers can face on a daily basis. And I love doing that. And one of the things that we do, and I've done this in many of my roles, is customer advisory boards and events and activities where you truly seek out inputs and feedback from customers. And you have to be open-minded because sometimes they come from a point of despair or frustration. And the absolute objective you need to have is to deliver value every single day for customers. So when you hear them complain or share some frustration about some elements of your offering that they don't get, you better listen, because this is an indication that perhaps something has been miscalibrated on both sides in terms of expectation or in terms of quality of delivery. And I love those moments. They're learning moments. They're learnings of deep empathy. And you'd be surprised how effective this can be when you take action immediately and solve the problem with the customer and become a true partner. So I love to do that. I love to go and see customers on a regular basis, just seek their input and do everything I can to continue to deliver value. So I encourage a lot of the marketers, CMOs and likes to just deliver those moments, those platforms of feedback, whether it's a user group, a customer advisory board, or even I would say visits. You could create an executive business review format with them. But seeking out feedback is really important. And it's not just a job of a customer success team, by the way. It's a job of every person who interacts with customers.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, as marketers, we're out there making this promise to customers, right? So it does make sense that we should on the back end make like, see how well it's being fulfilled and help improve things when they're not. Because we're trying to set up, I think, this communication to customers, to the ideal customer. This is a good fit for you, and not communicating to other customers that it's a fit for them. It's not going to be a fit for everyone. And that makes me think of your next lesson here, which I mentioned in the opening, find the place where you thrive, right? Because that's what it's all about. I think sometimes you see a job opening and it's just tick, tick, tick. Okay, you know this platform, you know that platform, you know that platform. Great, that's where I go. I know all those platforms. But really, same thing with customers. I don't think really any good or bad organizations or good or bad products is good or bad for the right person. So how did you find the place where you thrive? How did you learn this lesson?
You know, I've found a sweet spot, which is where I am today in the sort of growing, scaling up size of a company. So you're not a startup, but you're not yet an enterprise. You're sort of in the middle. And your job is to actually just really organize, structure the teams. The way I found it, I'll tell you that story, is when I joined SAP Ariba. I had been with SAP, the mothership, for a couple of years, about 7 years at the time, across Australia, Singapore, and the US. And I was asked to join the SAP Ariba team as a go-to-market liaison. What does that mean? My job specifically was to be a bridge between product teams and marketing teams. And I found myself in chaos land. Like, I literally arrived, and on day two, I was told that the relationship between marketing and product was not good. And to make matters worse, we had less than 3 months to organize an event, very large event, the biggest conference of SAP. It was called SAP Ariba Live at the time. And we were not prepared. We were supposed to package a dozen innovations and do the work between marketing and product to get ready for the big show. So obviously, the pressure was on me to figure out why. Why is it that what was going on? What was it that didn't work? And realizing that the teams just didn't operate the same way, didn't have the same language, and was starting to just, you know, blame each other in some capacity. Short answer is they were not getting along at all, and the work was stalling, and we were running out of time. So what I did actually is, what was funny, it was in the Palo Alto office. The marketing team was on one building, the product team was on the other building, and none of them were communicating, and they were using the kitchen area in the middle as a neutral place to meet. That's just how comical it was. The first thing I did is I relocated myself into the product building. I was there every day with them, and I was seeking to understand how they worked. And within a month, we started working really closely together, getting along. I would understand how the teams really worked. They deeply cared about the product. And I found myself being a valuable asset because I could structure their thinking. I'll repeat that. I could structure their thinking. I was listening. I was learning from them. I was not judgmental. I was just seeking out to understand, and they really embraced me because I was showing up every single day with respect, with empathy, with a calming presence. And I would take all of the information, I would structure the information for them and with them. And at the end, which was probably 2 months later, we co-presented the way we would organize and present the innovations on stage, how we would organize and present the content. And within 3 months, not only were we prepared, we created 150 assets together, co-presented the whole plan. It was a massive success. What I found in there is that I had found an ability to structure teams who would otherwise just not have the time, nor maybe the skill set to get organized and structure the work the way I was able to. And that was my aha moment, so to speak. That's when I realized I have something I can bring to teams here without making them feel any other way than successful and prepared. And that became a secret and super power of mine and secret weapon. I realized I could come to any organization and start structuring teams, processes, presentations, projects with a deep level of collaboration with team and just really become a force multiplier. So I found that sweet spot, and then I was able to replicate it in every company I've worked for.
So that's great. So one way I would talk about that is you like finding your personal value proposition, right? Like this is that's my right. value proposition, right? Yeah. So let me ask you then again, the same like kind of facing externally about a company's value proposition externally about, you talk about the structuring things externally. So one thing that's really struck me in looking through your LinkedIn and your career is you were the CMO of Dropbox during the start of the COVID pandemic, right? Yeah.
That's right.
So, let me ask about that, because that was a time where, I mean, Dropbox, it would seem to be poised to take advantage of all the things that were going on during the pandemic with the work from home thing. So I wonder, at that time, was there anything you did to structure Dropbox differently internally or externally, or set up that value proposition differently, pivot that value proposition differently in that moment? Because, for example, I can't believe I'm talking about COVID twice already in the beginning of the interview, but I wrote an article about how the pandemic inspired brands to rethink their marketing strategy. I did a case study with WebEx Cisco, and that was a time where they rebranded from a web conferencing company to a hybrid collaboration platform, right? One seamless app for everything, calls, meetings, messaging, events, et cetera. Because suddenly web conferencing became everything, right? It wasn't just that one-off thing you do externally. So I wonder for you, Tim, you did that. You gave that great example of how you structured things internally, found that place where you thrive, found your personal value proposition. What did you do with Dropbox when just everything was hitting like that during COVID? Like, how did you structure that company?
So I love my time at Dropbox because this was another moment of transformation, number one. And then second is I got a chance to work with incredible people. And what happened when I started is we already, even just before COVID started, and I started in January, so it was just at the very beginning of the year, what I had in mind was to completely digitize marketing. So we were at this juncture where we're wondering, should we do a big conference in person or should we think about a different approach? And my recommendation right off the bat was to create an online digital experience. That was very much a vision that I had based on the ability to just really engage with audiences and just capture inbound much more effectively. And because Dropbox had this dual business model where part of their business is recurring self-serve revenue, which is product-led growth, and another part is sales-led, I had to find ways to just create efficiencies out of the budget. So I was like, well, yeah, we should create a digital experience and perhaps just really shift to an online model. And then COVID hit. So to me, it was the perfect situation where I didn't have, like many other companies, I didn't have to overnight cancel my big conference to turn into a virtual event. I was lucky because I had thought about that just before COVID hit. So in some ways, I had a little bit of a head start. It doesn't mean that it wasn't complicated, because overnight we had to turn off all of our physical events, not just big conferences, but regional events, industry events, obviously. So we had to do this pretty quickly, but I didn't have the burden of just having to switch, a real in-person conference to an online experience, because I had already started the process. So it took us about 9 months to create an integrated digital experience, which we unveiled online. And the goal was to just really redirect most of our audience into that online experience and generate some inbound out of it. And it was a huge fit for the team, because you have to do it at scale across many, many different stakeholders and work through a whole system strategy and platform strategy. But it was something I really enjoyed doing. And it was serendipitous that it happened during COVID, because this became a forcing function to actually get into that online experience. So that's a tangible example that I like to use when an otherwise difficult situation, COVID, becomes an opportunity for you to actually completely transform the way you work.
I like that. I mean, a difficult situation, and you use that to do something positive. So also, I'd mention, you talked about it being lucky, and it may be in some ways, but it is visionary in a way too. Like, you could not know that COVID would hit, but it wasn't just that COVID hit and then we worked from home. COVID accelerated trends that were going on, right? I mean, obviously, if COVID happened in 1900 or when the big flu happened, like, people didn't start working from home, right? It just didn't work. So COVID accelerated trends that were going on. So that's very, I think, modest to call it serendipity and luck, but I would also say that's pretty visionary. So, here's another lesson. You said become a natural collaborator. What is a natural collaborator, and how do you become one? I mean, I love the idea of collaboration. That's what the whole second half of the episode is about, how I made it marketing, about what people we collaborate with. What do you mean by natural collaborator, and how did you become one?
I think that one other aha moment I had, and I remember sometimes some snippets of wisdom I get from people along my career. I was in Australia early in my career. And, you know, first of all, when I joined Australia, I was about 26 years old. My English was not great. Let me be clear. It was just not really great. So I had to try to really fit in a place that was thousands and thousands of miles away from my hometown. It was very, very lonely down under. And you really do everything you can to succeed, because if you don't, you're back home. And my objective was to build an international career. So it was very important for me to find a way to be successful. And one of my colleagues told me this very big advice. He said, there's one secret, Tiffin. People have to like working with you. It doesn't matter how good you are on paper. It doesn't matter how good you are at performing and generating results. People don't like you, you're done. You're not going to go anywhere. And I always remember that. People need to like you. So, of course, you could say, okay, so does that mean that you need to be a people pleaser? No, I didn't say that. It just means that if people like working with you, you will find a way together to solve problems. You will find a way together to work on delivering great outcomes. So that's the first thing. Be a likable person, that so that people, when they wake up and they know they have a meeting with you, they look forward to seeing you. They want to collaborate with you, or they come to you because they know you can help them. You can solve problems, right? And it matters. It matters a great deal. The way you behave, the way you conduct yourself as a colleague, as a partner, matters to people. You know, there's this sentence, I believe, which is, people will always remember how you make them feel. That is so true. And if you want to thrive and just really go up in your career, that's one key: diplomacy. Finding a way to work well with people and just being the person that people want in the room with them.
Yeah, so I agree with being likable, and I think that's a very good point. I think that's, you know, sometimes we say the jerks get ahead in business, or, you know, I won't use other words, like, that's the way to do it. So I agree with being likable. Well, let me ask this, when it comes to collaboration, like, you had a great example before, but you were more like in kind of in a peer role, right, where you're between those two teams and kind of making things work. But now, as we talked about, you're a CMO, you got, I think we said, a team of 60. And I wonder, how does collaboration change when you become a leader? Because you are not on equal footing with the people you're trying to collaborate with, right? So, for example, you know, you're higher in the org chart. So I interviewed Paul Krasinski, the CEO and founder of Epicenter Experience. And one of his lessons was, when it comes to collaboration, there's no place for top-down management when creating something new. And he told a story that really stuck with him earlier in his career. He was working with Arbitron, and he was meeting with Apple iTunes. He was starting to help them with the measurement, and he had this big meeting. And it wasn't until the end of the meeting that he realized the person that he met with was the whole head of iTunes. And because the guy didn't even share his title, right? He was just so humble. And I thought that was a great example. But for you, like, how do you lead now that you are, you're at the top of the org chart, or like not the CEO, but very close there? How does that change how you collaborate?
Well, I'll share another story of how I became CMO in the first place and how I learned to actually lead leaders. Because when you become a chief of something, you don't just lead teams, you lead leaders. And that's a big one. So obviously, by definition, you have to learn to collaborate with other leaders. The one person that inspired me on my journey is Barack Obama, believe it or not. So I was reading his biography. I was really trying to understand how someone who only had 2 years in the Senate became president and was able to actually command, be the chief of armies and command so many, powerful leaders without having such experience himself. It's quite a feat. And he did twice. So I was like, how did he manage to do this? And I read about him, and he would come to meetings with people who were like 30 years older than him, had decades long experience, decades more expertise than him. But that's the point, isn't it? Is you have to surround yourself with great leaders and great people and just really seek advice from the people who are at the table with you. So to me, the way I learned to do it is just hire great leaders around me and accept that I'm not the smartest in the room. My job is to hire the smarter people. If I think I'm going to be the smartest one, there's no way I can collaborate effectively with great minds. There's always going to be this power struggle. Instead, I'm far more comfortable hiring people who are extremely competent, far more than me, in their function, empower them and seek advice and ask for help. So a typical meeting would be, I have today three strong leaders in my team, and I always ask questions, say, how would you do this? Help me understand how we can get from this point to another. What is your advice? What do you recommend? And when I do this, I turn, first of all, I turn the accountability to them, but I give them a chance to lead me indirectly, of course, but to lead with a recommended direction. And I find this to be extremely powerful. That to me is the key to collaboration. In fact, it's the key to leadership. And it's a mental switch you need to do, to your point, when you go from being a peer and collaborator to being a leader. You actually have to push the accountability down to your own leaders, give them an ability to actually lead back up to you. So it's a reverse process, and it's not necessarily always a natural one for people. But once you get it, once you understand the power of it, you can hardly come back. And that's where you learn to just really empower teams and get the best out of them.
Well, we're going to talk much more about collaborating. Like I said, that's the whole second half of the episode. We talk about lessons from people we collaborated with. But first, I should mention that the How I Made It in Marketing podcast is underwritten by MechLabs, the parent organization of Marketing Sherpa. MechLabs AI now has 13 expert assistants to help you with your marketing, along with a guided headline writing pathway to write a powerful headline, all trained on a methodology built on the results from 10,000 marketing experiments. It's totally free. You don't even have to register for now. Just go to mechlabsai.com and start using it. That's MECLABSAI.com to get artificial intelligence working for your marketing. All right, let's take a look at some lessons from people you collaborated with. You mentioned Alicia Tillman, the CMO of Delta Airlines, and you said from Alicia you learned that branding shapes success for companies and leaders. So how did you learn this lesson? I mean, it seems like kind of what we learn in, business school and, you know, kind of the basics, but how did you actually learn it?
So first of all, Alicia is one of those incredible women and CMOs. I had the good fortune of working with her, for her, when I was at Calibra, and she inspired me every single day. She really taught me the power of personal brand and the power of brand in general for any company. So it started with when I joined Ariba, she was in the middle of rebranding the company. So it's interesting to look at the process itself of rebranding it. It's a very intense process because you have to go deep into the identity of a company. You have to really ask, what is the purpose of the company and how is it different? Or how is that the same, but somewhat different? You know what I mean? You have to continue to be true to the purpose of the company, but you have to make sure that the brand meets the moment. And that's exactly what she did. And first of all, she surrounded herself with great agencies and great minds to do it. So that was the first one that I thought was important. And the quality of the work was really important for her. It had to feel right. It had to feel highly qualitative. So how do you get to a point where you know what's really qualitative versus what's not? Here's my hint. You have to exhibit that yourself. I'm going to say it again. You have to exhibit that quality. You have to strive for high quality, high branding yourself. So every day, Alicia would lead by example. It's someone who used to live in Jersey. She used to commute, I think, 4 hours per day, 2 hours each time. She would always come impeccably dressed, impeccably showing, always, always, always showing and displaying a higher quality of brand. And for her, she was seeking out always the highest level of quality in the work. So if it was just not hitting that quality level, she would just respectfully send the work back and just ask for the teams to push it a little bit more, just a little bit more. But exhibiting the quality means you have to leave that quality yourself. And she really taught everybody about the power of a quality brand, a beautiful brand. And there I say she was working for American Express before, so she probably learned that herself working for a very high-quality brand. And it matters. It really matters. And I had a chance to talk to her many times, and she said that she was observing in the way she was looking at talent, succession plan. She was looking at someone who would be the full package. So someone who exhibits quality, someone who is highly qualitatively branded, because when you're in a role like a CMO, you have to represent the company. So you have to be always really well put together. And someone who just has that executive presence and ability to just really exhibit a great, elegant, qualitative presence. And I thought to me that this was one really important thing. And I will tell you, everything matters. The way you dress, the way you speak, the way you walk, your presence, like you come in the room and you have to exhibit all of those things. So does your brand. The brand of a company has to be so good and consistently done that it becomes uniquely differentiated because of its intrinsic quality. So you have to strive for quality, in my view, is what makes a great brand what it is, and you have to do it consistently. And that's the key, in my view, is consistency and the ability to repeat that over and over in a very consistent way, whatever the style is chosen, matters also a great deal.
So let's talk about, I love this, because I this is something I've thought about a lot. Let's talk about how to scale this through humans, because I think that's where it really gets difficult, right? Because I feel like every customer touch point is a thing of value, right? But how do you scale that brand through humans? So it's one thing to say, oh, our brand's going to be perfect in the Wall Street Journal ad, and it's going to be perfect on the website, and they're going to walk into that event, and it's going to be so powerful. I'll give you one small example from my own career. This is what got me thinking of this years ago. I was, I got a washing machine, I think, or something like that from a major store, right? And it was before I worked from home. So I actually came home to wait for it. I'm working and I hear this big clunky truck driving past my house. I live on a cul-de-sac, so I knew they were like turning around. But it was like some big rental truck with like a trailer behind it. Or I was like, oh, that's not my washing machine or whatever. And then it comes back around and yeah, sure enough, someone comes out, they're just wearing whatever t-shirt and shorts, they have whatever rental truck, and they bring in my washing machine and put it in. And I was just thinking, I was like, what was the business decision behind that? Because I could see in that meeting room, there's someone in charge of services or delivery logistics that says, we could save 10% by going with outsourced contractors, right? But where was marketing to say, wait a minute, there's a certain brand experience where they bought this, you know, in our showroom, and then someone's going to show up, walk into their house and do these things in their house and have that experience, which was totally unbranded and just seemed like any random person off the street. So that's where I ask you, Tim, and I challenge you, where does that come in? Where, again, we can have that perfect ad or event, but how do you get each person that represents your brand to actually represent it in the way you want? Like I said, in that high quality way.
So let me try to answer this with giving also perhaps some examples. I actually thrive to bring consistency in what I do as a marketer every day. And one thing I'm very big on is integrated marketing. What I mean by that is, for example, if we launch a team, we launch a product, we launch a program, what I expect from my team is an integrated plan end to end. Easier said than done, obviously, right? What I mean by this is like, I want to see what the brand team is doing, the creative team. I want to see what the social team's doing, the demand gen plan, pre, during, and post. I want to see the enablement strategy. You get where I'm going. Like every single part of the plan needs to be connected, sequenced, and there has to be some coordinated effort across multiple cross-functional teams. And everybody keeps telling me, this can't be done. We are too early. We don't have the processes. I've heard that so many times, I can't even count. But here's the key. You have to start with a vision. You need to really set the gold standard. You need to really lead with what I call the North Star vision. Everybody should have a North Star vision. In short, you need to set expectation about the high bar quality and never put it down. If you lower the bar, people will just reach the lowest level of the bar because you did lower that bar. So my goal is always to raise the bar and say, this is what a true integrated experience should look like and work the team toward that goal. Is it going to be perfect? No. Usually it takes me a year to really bring teams and, you know, show them how to build truly integrated plans. And it always starts the same way. It's too hard to do. We don't have the processes. We don't have, you're asking something impossible. I'm like, oh, really? Is that true? Because it's my first CMO stint and I do that every time. And every time the teams are learning. So it's also making people do things that they don't yet believe in or they don't yet see. But you've done that before. So you know the outcome. You know they will get there. The brand is the same. You believe in the brand, you have a purpose, you have a vision, you give a North Star to the teams and you train them through it and you monitor progress. It may take 6 months, it may take a year, but they will eventually get there because you gave them a North Star and your North Star was the high bar. And you have to repeat and reiterate that North Star on a very regular basis at every chance you have. So you have all hands, you have communications, just reiterate the brand, the expectation on the quality of the brand. Reward teams when you see them reach a milestone. So when they've used a good brand, to tell them you've done a great job, it looks phenomenal. Just try to train them to do it and monitor the progress as you go through. The other element, which is critical, is enablement. Teams won't know what great looks like or won't even practice what great looks like unless you teach them how to do it. So I really believe in the ability to enable teams really well. You could create a brand kit, a training in the box, an ability to just really get the teams to a point where that becomes second nature for them, but they have to learn it. It's a new muscle. So enablement is also very key in driving whatever transformation, especially on the brand side, you need.
Yeah, and something you mentioned earlier when we were talking, and I think it probably ties into this lesson as well, your next lesson, empowerment and accountability, cultivate leadership at every level. I would imagine when you're talking about that cross brand, that all the way across the organization branding, it's that empowerment and accountability that you're putting at every level in the organization. You mentioned you learned this from Barry Padgett, the CEO of Amperity. How did you learn that from Barry? Seems like such a key leadership lesson.
Oh, Barry is one of my all-time favorite leaders. I've rarely seen someone who is just so confident in his ability to lead. I learned it from him. First of all, we had a great relationship. He was saying a few words to me. Our meetings were always very short, and I got only a few pieces of advice or wisdom from him, but they were always extremely valuable, and that was one of them. The ability to push the accountability down is all of us leaders have escalations. Who doesn't, right? Well, it becomes apparent that escalation is actually a very big deterrent to enforcing accountability. So you could have, for example, two or few VPs or direct reports coming and not agreeing on something. So they come to you and they basically escalate a problem, right? It could be any kind of problem. It's not just only unique to marketing. It could happen. The first question I usually ask is, have you talked to each other? Did you pick up the phone? Did you actually have a conversation before you escalated to me? And I will tell you, 9 times out of 10, they didn't talk to each other. So that's the first rule. Is pushing the accountability means you have to hold the teams responsible for their behavior and be like, fix and work the things together instead of escalating it back to me. So that's usually a typical question I ask. Did you talk to the person? The second is the way as a team is, if you disagree in front of me as peers, it means you haven't figured it out. So I don't want to be your brainstorm buddy. I'm going to ask you to figure out a path and then you come back to me when you're aligned, which usually works. It means that they're probably a week or two away from brainstorming with each other, aligning, but the goal is you have to come to me with a joint approach. If you can't, then okay, then I understand then there's probably a bigger alignment issue and then we probably need to work through a process or resetting roles and expectations and KPIs. But if all of these have been done, you just need to come prepared and come back with a joint proposition. So I always push it back. I always push it down and be like, if you are an expert, if I have hired you as an expert, you should advise me. You should come with an advice and element, not the other way around. So I hold them accountable to figure it out, to find an answer, and to collaborate better with each other. So that's what I learned from Barry. And it works almost all the time, is pushing the accountability to the people you have hired who are experts, hold them accountable and responsible, and then just make sure that you seek out the inputs from them. But if you try to fix it for them, first of all, it's called micromanagement,
yeah,
which I usually don't like, but it means you have a problem. It's like if you have to intervene to fix it, it means that your leaders are not delivering what they're supposed to deliver. So you have to just reiterate that accountability one more time. And if you see that as a pattern, they can't hold up to that accountability, then obviously you have a bigger challenge.
So how do you use those same skills that you're teaching your team to use within the C-suite, within your peers, presenting to CEOs, chairmen, investors, analysts, boards? Because, for example, when I interviewed Regina DeMars, Director of Content Marketing and Strategy at First National Bank, on How I Made It Marketing, one of her lessons was lead by example rather than micromanaging, like you're talking about. And she talked about early in her career how she learned that at Weber Shandwick. And I wonder for you, like now, like, yes, you're teaching those skills to your team. I'm sure, you know, you have to lead that by example as well, right? If you could teach this and then they see the C-suite and it's, oh my gosh, you know, there's all these like territory battles or whatever, political battles, it wouldn't work. So have you learned anything? And I think this is your fourth CMO role we talked about, like in coming into that CMO role and how you work with your peers in the C-suite.
Yeah. So I try as much as I can to apply the same. So what I typically do is, if, for example, we have to present to our president, I'm typically going to go to our head of strategy and operation, who is somebody who's worked with him four times, to seek advice, prepare, do a prep with that person. So you have to know who are the people who hold the true power, who hold the true line of inference. That's part of your job. Think of it as you need to sign an act of Congress and you need to find within Congress who holds the cards and who has access and who is capable of just giving you the right inputs. It's no different. It's the same thing. So I typically go to our SVP of strategy and operations because he has a pretty good idea of what's going to work and what's not going to work and prepare. And it works all the time. So it's just having an ability to prep as a team, seek advice from the advisors and be like, how do you think Thomas would do this? Do I have the right flow? Or do I have the right level of information? Is it detailed enough? And I prepare immensely with the people in the know ahead. And that's true partnership. And believe it or not, when asked for help, help always comes. If you ask genuinely for help with people and are grateful for it and give them credit, you know, first of all, they'll work with you again, but they'll enjoy working with you because you're problem solving together, which is intellectually gratifying to anyone. So I try to do that as much as I can with my colleagues. Sometimes we power together before we go and present to our boss and we're like, okay, how do we come together and as a single voice? So it's the same thing is, we don't want to appear disjointed or misaligned in front of our leadership or the leadership's leadership. So let's prepare together and sign off on something as a unit versus singular teams.
Yeah, the meeting before the meeting, right?
Correct.
One last lesson. You said bridge marketing and product for collaborative growth. I think this is the lesson we talked about earlier, but you said you learned this from Sudhir Bhajwani, the co-founder and CEO of Oral Lab. So what role did Sudhir play in that story we heard earlier and what did you learn?
Yeah, so remember when I moved to the building? So Sudhir is the boss of that building. So very, very quickly when I joined Ariba and decided to move to the building of the product team, it was very clear that Sudhir was the person who was just really holding the card. And he was just the most wonderful person. But he was holding a lot of power, good power in the sense that he had a following. People would come and if Sudhir said, hey, we need to continue to code and I'm going to order 50 pizzas for the whole floor and we need to stay, everybody would stay. If he was like, hey, we need to come back on a Saturday because we are 2 months from launching on stage and we really, really need to push for it, everybody would come, including myself. So I observed him. I took the time to understand how he thinks, how he works, how he created such a following and respect and command over his team. So you have to just really, really observe how it's done. What I learned from him is he was very much in the details. He wanted words to be exact. He wanted the experience and the brand to reflect exactly his product. And what I learned, a tangible, valuable lesson I learned from him is product people, they build the product, it's their baby. it matters to them. This put their sweat in there. It's highly complex to do. And if, as a marketer, you come up with the wrong positioning and the wrong messaging, it's offensive to them because it's like you're dressing the baby the wrong way, right? You're taking your baby out and it's cold and you don't put enough clothing on them, like nobody would feel right. It's the same. It feels the same for them. So I developed some level of empathy and understanding of how product leaders think about the product. It's their baby. So you have to be deeply connected to the way they see the baby in a way and try to dress it appropriately. So one example I had is when we had to work about launching this product called guided buying. It was guided buying procurement. And we had to find a slogan. We had to find a way to work through it and a short description. So he had his way of looking at the description. So I had a column with Sudhir's input on how it should ring. Then I had the agency input. And then I had the CEO input. And I had to work through three variations to see which variation would work. And it was an exchange, right? It was really a partnership across the CEO, Sudhir, and the marketing agency. And we found a way because we would put it side by side, the three options, we would test and run and do it. But the best way to me to collaborate is to get people into the process with you, not put them aside from it, but just have them directly engaged. And you eventually find a way. But the first thing is have them engage, respect their work, respect their inputs, and then negotiate. It all comes down to negotiating, but they have to be part of it.
So there's a lot of voices in that room, like you talk about when you're collaborating. And I wonder, how do you also bring the voice of the customer into that room? Because I interviewed Onaisa Landis on How I Made It Marketing. She's a vice president of marketing for Octane. One of her lessons was to market effectively, you have to think beyond what your product does. You have to understand the role it plays in your customers' lives. One thing I really like what she did when she went to her organization, they did their financing for dealerships of like power supplies. And she interviewed the customers, like, you know, we talked about, you did. But one thing that she really got into too was understanding their lives outside of the product itself, and then understanding, okay, how does the product tie into, you know, their goals in their life, which I thought was brilliant. And so you talked a lot about, you know, even previously customer interviews you did earlier in your career and how you got close to the customer. So I wonder, in these situations, we got product, we got marketing, we got the CEO, we got the marketing agency. Oh my gosh, we got so much going on. How do we make sure we bring the voice of the customer in there as well?
I love that question because this is at the core of what we do here at Amplitude. So one of the things we do as a company is we offer user behavior insights to any company who wants to deeply understand what users want across their experience, their customer journey, whether it's an offline or online journey. And from what seeking and understanding what they want, what makes them come back, purchase again, what makes them drop off and not complete any online experience, requires access to data, input, feedback. It's part of the process. So any process that you start, which is usually a life cycle, from ideation to strategy to planning to building to executing to measuring, you got to seek out feedback. So you can get feedback, either qualitative or quantitative feedback. So you could get anecdotal qualitative feedback in the process. You could do cabs, customer cabs. You could run surveys. You could do all kinds of inputs that gives you that qualitative feedback that you need. Or you can let the data, the customer data, speak. That to me is at the core of everything we should do. In fact, I actually really believe that data is the greatest unifier and the greatest equalizer you can use as a marketer, but also as a product leader. It informs the insights that you get out of data, informs strategy, informs action, right? So in that particular case, I'll give you a very tangible example. that happened to us last year with our president. We wanted to redo our amplitude.com homepage. Lots of opinions here when it comes to a homepage. The color, the placement, the tagline, the navigation bar. And I'll always remember, and if Thomas listens to the podcast, he hopefully will laugh with me. He didn't like the color that the brand team had put as an option. He preferred the darker version of the color. So we were like, well, Thomas, you know, we actually really believe that the lighter color is very much the type of color that our audience is going to like for X and Y reasons. So he was still like, yeah, but I really don't like it. We should go with a dark color. So what we did is experiment. We A-B tested the two colors. You want to bet which color worked best?
Oh, the dark color. No question. Looks richer.
Nope.
Was it the light color?
It was the light color. It was not the dark color. But how would you know unless you run the test and the data tells you? So we let the data tell the real story. We came back to him and he was like, oh, I was wrong. He respected the feedback because the data showed what customers, actually what users and customers prefer. So data is the answer.
I love that. Actually,
a lot of times to us, in fact, we think data is the answer.
Yeah, and I love the A-B testing example. At one point, I interviewed the team behind the Obama re-election campaign. You were talking about Obama before. And at the point, they had done more A-B testing than any other organization ever, like $500 million worth. And they even they said 50-50. We were no better than chance in guessing. We were no better than a coin flip. So I love that example. But it brings up, you talked about so many different things about what it means to be a marketer in our conversation. If you had to break it down, Tiffin, what are the key qualities of an effective marketer?
Oh. Well, lead with empathy. Have empathy for your team, for your customer, whether it's internal customer or external customer. Be curious. Intellectual curiosity. It's just really important. As a marketer, you have to be always steps ahead of others. What are the trends in the market? Marketing is fast evolving. The marketing today is very different than marketing 5-10 years ago. So you have to be constantly ahead of the trends. You have to deeply understand them, but you have to be open, intellectually open and curious. Otherwise, you're going to be left behind. Like we can no longer just run the same playbook that we did a couple of years ago. So intellectual curiosity, empathy, data. You have to be comfortable with data. So if you don't have some level of dashboarding in front of you every day, whether it's Tableau, Salesforce, or even Amplitude, if you're looking at your web or product metrics and analytics and campaign analytics, then I strongly suggest you get trained on it. You asked to be trained on it because this is what's going to happen to any marketer, just having an ability to really lead with data. I will tell you why. Whenever my teams are coming up with a proposal of any kind, my first question is, what's the projected outcome? What do you seek out to achieve? What are your core objectives? What are the estimated outcomes? If they don't know, then I said, well, come back, figure it out, work with the teams, but we cannot start something we can't measure. So measurement matters a great deal to being, like I would say, modern marketer. So empathy, data, an ability to be intellectually curious would probably be some of those. And the last but not least, think in an integrated fashion. Don't just think into your own silo or your own KPI. Marketing is the sum of many cross-functional parts. When you run marketing, you not only have to optimize for your channel, the marketing channel, but sometimes you have to optimize for other channels, sales channels, partner channels. For example, if you're in a B2B space where you have a sales-led model, you have to optimize for many parts of the organization. Brand does not just apply to a marketing team. Brand applies to a company, to customers. So you have, by definition, you have to really optimize for a much larger audience than just yourself and your team. So you have to be far more integrated, have an integrated vision into what you do to support the company, to support the customers.
Well, thank you for sharing these lessons and these stories with our curious audience. I learned so much from you, Tiffin.
I'm glad I had a chance to share these stories with you, Daniel.
And thanks to everyone for listening.
Thank you for joining us for How I Made It in Marketing with Daniel Burstein. Now that you've gotten inspiration for transforming yourself as a marketer, get some ideas for your next marketing campaign from Marketing Sherpa's extensive library of free case studies at marketingsherpa.com. That's marketingsherpa.com.